Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio. I'm your host, Kevin Barrett, waging the Truth Jihad. Four or five great guests per week, telling it like it is outside of the mainstream box. Today, I'm getting a chance to talk to one of my, well, heroes, I guess. Somebody I've looked to since long before I was even doing this as someone doing very, very interesting and important work. That's David Pidcock. He was the founder of the Islamic Party of Britain back in the day and is still going strong, telling it like it is, exposing truths and truths about Islam, which are even more important now, perhaps, in this climate of Islamophobia than they ever have been. We have some great work coming out from him recently about the revelation that a king of Britain actually considered converting to Islam and becoming allied to Morocco. That's not one that you learn about in the history books. And then how about Napoleon converting to Islam? We've heard rumors. Let's get the facts. Welcome, David Pidcock. How are you?
Thank you very much, Kevin. Thank you. And for the I'm the co-founder of the Islamic Party of Britain. My colleague is Sahih Mustaqim Blair, a German convert, who is now called the Flying Imam, because he flies all over the world as a pilot. But yes, it was something that in the wake of the Rushdie affair, when people started burning books, this didn't seem like a very sensible thing to do, because as soon as you start to burn books, it means that you don't have an argument in response to what was written. Mm-hmm. So that's how it came about. And I understand it's the first Islamic party in the West. It was 1989. And so we were able to get certain things on the agenda, which you couldn't do, you know, normally, particularly in those days, long before YouTube and things like that. So we stood in the election and we raised the issue of Rushdie and the falsity of the claims. And that was the beginning of what we've been working on since that day. But for myself personally, I started in 1975. Having met an American Muslim in Jeddah and made my Shahada in Newark, New Jersey. So it's interesting, you know, how things go around, and I'm talking to you now back in the States, so this is good, very, very
right.
good.
Right, yes, I came to Islam actually in 1993 in San Francisco, and that's a story in itself, but I'll let people read about that in my book, Truth Jihad. But when you started with your political involvement around the Rushdie affair, I think it's worth pointing out that there's a kind of a tension or even a dialectic in Muslims' responses to these sorts of provocations between the people who go out and threaten and threaten violence and burn the book without even having read it, on the one hand, which is kind of the obscurantist element in among Muslims, and there are some, let's face it, versus those who choose to try to wage what I would call the truth jihad, or that is a sort of intellectual struggle that has as its bottom line the search for truth. And I appreciate that that was the path that you took, and I think that's the right path.
Well, the intriguing thing about the Rushdie bit, the book that we actually did was this one called Satanic Voices, Ancient and Modern. But what the burning of the book, it turned out subsequently, was not nothing other than a ploy by a Bradford-based Islamic finance company who wanted to raise their profile by burning the book. And this was the catastrophe that resulted from that was, you know, stupidity, as we say, if you watch the film The Four Lions, how easy it is to radicalize idiots. But he burnt the book and lit the thing was purely as a marketing ploy. People then from Bradford put £1.8 million into his company, which he then absconded and left the country. And wow. Hasn't been seen since.
Unbelievable.
So, talk about, yes.
And Salman Rushdie was laughing all the way to the bank, because this was a tremendous publicity stunt for him and for his publisher.
Absolutely. And nobody can say, well, maybe they weren't behind it anyway, but that may be a little far too far to the right in believing that. But
that might be one of those rare conspiracy theories that are not true.
Very good, I like that. Yes, and so that was the really the beginning of realizing that the agenda has been hijacked by people who have a pecuniary interest in using Islam for their own agenda. And of course, this has we fought against that and tried to raise the awareness of that to people, that Islam may be built on five pillars, but that doesn't make us fifth columnists, as somebody mentioned the other day. But the content of the book, the Quran clearly is its own best defense. It mentions that never did we send a messenger or a prophet, but when he recited the message, also recited vanity, which came from within himself, but Allah took out whatever vanity Satan threw in. And so the point was that the argument of Rushdie was demolished in that, basically in that one throw. The satanic verses are mentioned in the Quran, and they come from the nafs. But of course, this story was too good to call.
And the nafs, for our listeners who are not aware of these things, the nafs is the Islamic term for the ego, desiring ego, and then the nafs al-amra bisu is the ego that desires evil. And this is a very important concept. It really is the basis of an incredible psychology.
Oh, indeed. And just this week, I found one of the very best compilations by a Christian on YouTube about the origins of the system that operates, you know, with false flags. And I'm going to send that to you. I'm just literally downloading it at the moment. But the agenda has been around for a long time. And part of the book that I wrote, the first book was Satanic Voices, was actually to cover the secret societies and the Masonic Freemasonry. And of course, this plays a massive part when you walk around Washington, as I did on several occasions, to see all the symbolism in Washington and to realize that what we're really up against is really, you know, in broad daylight, is telling us, you know, who the enemy is. Mm-hmm. And yet Muslims, unfortunately, are faced to recognize that.
Right. Yes. And anyone who doesn't know what we're talking about when we talk about Washington, D.C. and Freemasonry, should maybe take a look at the Dan Brown novel, The Lost Symbol, which is, among other, it's not a terribly good novel, but it's a pretty good architectural tour of Washington, D.C. as one gigantic Freemasonic maze of symbols. And there's no question about that.
Absolutely. And this is what I've been trying over the many years, is actually to show that the system from Nimrod in Babylon till today is exactly the same. But one thing that was quite amazing in the Quran was that it tells you about all the symbols and all the things, but particularly is the brotherhood of nine brothers in the people of Ad and Thamud, who were exactly those who engage in the seventh degree of Freemasonry, which is the Royal Arch, and this Ikhwan, this brotherhood of nine, who meet, and they met to create false flag events and then lie in the morning. And we see exactly all the way through history, including Pearl Harbor and all the other things, the false flag events operated and controlled by this same brotherhood.
That's such fascinating stuff. I don't know if you've caught the latest piece by Gordon Duff at Veterans Today. It's one of his best pieces ever on this topic. And Gordon is a former intelligence officer from the three-letter agency that I better not name or they'll have to kill me, who went rogue several years ago and has been...
It's not KFC either.
Yeah, one of those. he while he was working in the intelligence community, he got to see all sorts of classified stuff referring, he says, to these extra-dimensional and perhaps also extraterrestrial intelligences, including basically what he's saying in his latest article, which he said many times, including on my show, is that much of our world is run by these Freemasonic Satanists who are essentially making a kind of a pact with demonic forces, and they get power, they get the various paranormal abilities, apparently, and sort of outside help at achieving wealth and power. And he specifically cites the investitures of the Rothschilds, where people who were basically made men or women in the Rothschild family at age 25 are invested with a demon that becomes their kind of familiar and guides them through life and so on and so forth. Anyway, Gordon has had some direct firsthand experience with the way that the American intelligence community deals with this sort of thing. And I think it's all too real. And even, you know, Gordon's not a religious believer. Frankly, I've had some clashes with him on that. But he's been forced to admit that this is real just based on his empirical, running headlong into it. If you bang into it, it's real.
I fully agree. I mean, I haven't read this particular article, but of course he's, like yourself, is highly regarded. And but my own involvement came from working in the machine tool industry in Sheffield, where I was born, and then coming across how things were arranged if you were submitting a tender for a project that you knew beforehand you'd won the tender, you'd won the project, because of the linkages through the lodges. And so I became, being brought up Roman Catholic, we were not allowed to join. But so it is empirical information or evidence. But there was over the past maybe two centuries, there's been a great debate over the invocation of a certain combination of words in the rituals that the people that you were talking about will have gone through from the first to the 33rd degree in the case of, Royal Arch or sort of English masonry. And I met a gentleman in we were talking about this yesterday in a series I was doing for ICRA Television I landed in Jeddah on the first day of Ramadan, 1975, and came across Ramadan, which I had no knowledge about. Anyway, we went to the hotel, the Red Sea Palace, and we couldn't get served because we were non-believers, and it was time for Sahur. And sitting there wondering what to do, and a very deep voice from behind me said, "You guys must be Limeys." And I turned round, and there was a very large gentleman, black American, obviously, but he looked like Moses or Charlton Heston. And he said, "Join me, and I'll get you some food." But his wife was able to decipher a combination of words that Freemasons watching this, or anybody, Jehovah Jabalon, Jehovah Jah. And she was able to then say, those who invoke this word or this combination of sounds call forth the compelling forces of Gehenim. And then the compelling forces basically invade the parties, and they then control them. And this has been going on for thousands of years. Back to Nimrod, because what people don't realize, they think that Freemasonry is to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem of Solomon, but it isn't. The first Grand Master of Freemasonry was Nimrod, Namrud, and he sent the Masons to build Nineveh, the city. So, but the whole concept of building Solomon's temple is a myth. That's just to draw people and Christians and others into belief that it is a divinely inspired organization, Freemasonry. But it isn't. It's exactly the opposite.
So if rebuilding the temple in Jerusalem isn't at the top of the Freemasonic agenda, what is the relationship then between Freemasonry and Zionism?
Well, it is symbiotic. And what the Quran tells us is that, talking about the entities that Gordon Duff was referring to, the Quran tells us that they follow what the jinn gave out falsely against the kingdom of Solomon. And Solomon was not a disbeliever, but that is the myth. My uncles, who were in the military, said we would never have risen above sergeant unless we'd actually joined the craft or joined the lodge. So It is a total myth that Christians, in terms of people like John Hagee and others, believe that what's been assembled in Jerusalem is something that is divinely inspired, but it isn't. It is the kingdom of Dajjal. It is that entity which is going to bring about the destruction of the world, unfortunately.
And that's precisely what Sheikh Imran Hossein says. Have you followed his analysis?
I did a program with him we were doing a project in Malaysia, and I've heard his analysis. The first book I did, and that what I found, Kevin, is that Muslims tend to have missed an awful lot of information. And there's one hadith that is particularly valuable. We know from the fact that the prophet who would come after Musa alayhi salam with a message has to be to give us all information till Yom al-Qiyamah. So whatever is to happen between now and the end of the world, he has given us all the information. But there's a cut-off point in Mishkat al-Masabi, and particularly Sahih Muslim. There's a very important hadith that says that the Prophet informs the Sahaba have you heard of a city of which part is on the sea? Yes, they said, understanding him to mean Constantinople. He said, Yom al-Qiyamah will not occur till 70,000 sons of Isaac, Ishaq, will attack it. But when they land down, they will not fight with arms or shower it with projectiles. They will simply say, La ilaha illallah, and one of its defenses will fall. They will recite it three times, and they will enter the city, gain control of the city, and then someone will say, Verily Dajjal has come out, and they will return to him. In Mishkat al-Masabi, the same hadith, there's an extension to it that says, from this day, count 6 years to Jihad Akbar. Then after 1 year, the emergence of Dajjal and revolution entering every Arab house, followed by mutual hatred and hostility between the Arabs. This hadith, or the confirmation of the event, is from the British Embassy in 1910, sending a letter basically saying that the coup d'etat, which took place on July the 8th, 1908, was conducted by 70,000 Masonic Jews from Salonika.
Really?
And so, yes, and this is all documented in my book. But what we have to go look at is Salonika plays a very important role. Where I'm sitting now, this cottage that I'm in at the moment was built around the time of 1668. But the village, basically, there was a massive plague here in the village of Eme, if you look on it. But what is interesting, the same year as the plague here, Shabbatai Zevi was a false messiah who the caliph, who was coming to liberate Al-Quds, Palestine. And the caliph ordered him either to turn back, submit, or lose his head. Now, Shabbatai Zevi was then, he embraced Islam, but was basically sent to Salonika, Thessaloniki. Now, from that day until today, all the people born in that city during that period were Mamzers, illegitimate. That includes Sheikh Kemal Ataturk, or Atashirk, as many people call him. Mm-hmm. Shabbatai Zevi's belief is the reverse. If you have the Ten Commandments, it is exactly the reverse of that. So they believe thou shalt kill, thou shalt commit adultery. So everyone, all the people who came from Salonika were illegitimate. They took control of Turkey, and most of them are still in power today.
These are the Danme Jews.
The
right?
Danme, correct. Yes. That's absolutely right. But they follow this belief of Shabbatai Zevi, and of course people like David Ben-Gurion and others, all the present... most of the present-day members of the Knesset and others either are directly or indirectly related and certainly follow his madhab, if you like.
So these were false converts to Islam who followed Shabbatai Zevi. Shabbatai Zevi was this insane false messiah who was guided by his political handler, Nathan of Gaza. And tried to take over the Ottoman Empire. And this would have happened in 1666, a very interesting numerical year.
Absolutely.
And so then the Ottoman Sultan said, well, if you are the Messiah, then when I try to execute you, it obviously won't work, right? And so then he, of course, Shabtai Zvi quickly said La ilaha illallah with his false confession, or his false conversion, to save his head. And ever since then, there have been all these false Muslims, these people who did this false conversion, who secretly follow this bizarre, inverted, satanic form of Judaism, as you said, reversing the Ten Commandments. And some say that they actually run Saudi Arabia, or at least there's an element of this in Saudi Arabia, which explains some of the horrific things going on there.
Well, look, of course, we're going to... I'm not afraid to tell the truth, or what I understand to be the truth. And the facts point to the fact that the hadith relate to Rasulullah was asked to bless Yemen, Sham, and the part in Saudi Arabia, where Riyadh is at the moment. And he refused. He said, because from here the horns of Satan will emerge. And I've studied the works of people who were sent to Palgrave, was sent by Benjamin Disraeli, the first Jewish Prime Minister of England, and he discovered a very strange thing. He said that the people of the what we would call the what we now know as the Saudi group thought that smoking tobacco was far more sinful than actually murdering somebody. So we see this astonishing belief, but they were the Rechabite Jews who continued, and basically throughout the Middle East we find the same tribes are still in power, but with an Islamic tarbush on their heads. Mm-hmm. So that's what we have to realize, that we have a very serious problem, because these people masquerade as Muslims, and they control the most holy places in Islam.
Right. Yeah, I believe the Ibn Saud family was involved in raiding caravans for quite a while.
Right.
And these were caravans, of course, going to the pilgrimage. So that's quite an unholy activity to have as your family business, and then become the custodians of the holy places.
Well, I think this is what the British have done throughout history. We've stolen everywhere. But in this case, it was Najd, which Rasulullah refused, alayhi salatu wasalam, to bless al-Najd, because from here the horns of Satan will emerge. And of course, we can see that the betrayal, the acceptance and the payment, we were paying Ibn Saud 20,000 silver dollars a month. And but the policy, when we look at, if we go back to the hadith I was referring to earlier, the timeline is absolutely precise to the month, basically. So July the 8th, 1908, is the fall of Constantinople to 70,000 sons of Isaac, who were illegitimate Masonic Jews. If we fast forward, then he said, from this day count 6 years to Jihad Akbar. Now, in July 1914, Archduke Ferdinand is assassinated in Sarajevo. Within the period of 6 years mentioned. Then, a few weeks later, by August 14th, the Great War, Jihad Akbar, is actually declared. Now, for the past 40-odd years, I've had debate or discussions with Muslims who've come to Sheffield University, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, but they're saying, well, no, a kafir cannot call for Jihad Akbar. But they fail to realize that Abdul Hamid, although he was under house arrest in the house of one of the bankers, he declared Jihad Akbar against the United Kingdom, against Britain, in favor of Germany. So the exact point where Jihad Akbar is declared. Now, if we then miss 1 year, as the Hadith say, it brings us exactly into 1916. And who emerges in June of 1916 but Lawrence of Arabia? Lawrence then creates the first Arab Spring, and what the Hadith says, that miss 1 year, then look for the emergence of Dajjal and revolution entering every Arab house, followed by mutual hatred and hostility between the Arabs. From that day, as soon as they embraced Arab nationalism, the die was cast. But Lawrence, like Tony Blair and George W. Bush and all these guys, went saying that Allah has a son, Allah Waladan. So whoever says Allah Waladan must be classified as Dajjal or Abdajjal. And that's this hadith is spot on now. The hadith that come after this were discovered recently. They've been hidden for nearly a century. And they were discovered in a library in Turkey. And a friend of mine, I was working with Al-Majj Television in Dubai, he and his mother translated them into English. And I'll send you the full copy of that shortly, inshallah.
Oh, inshallah. Well, that would be great. I'd love to see that. Yeah, it seems like this paradigm just keeps on flowing since the Jihad Akbar of World War I and the destruction of the caliphate, splitting up the Arab world into these nationalistic entities and then setting them at each other's throats. And never have they been at each other's throats as much as they are right now. We've got our contemporary Lawrences of Arabia organizing ISIS to destroy what's left of these cohesive nation states, essentially trying to just level the entire Middle East, it looks like. And do you think that that's being done primarily to slow the Islamic Renaissance? Is it being done to promote greater Israel? Or what's the bottom line here?
Well, I think if there is a document I was sent, I have an interesting family. My sister converted to Judaism and my cousin. And so when we've had dinner...
Must have interesting conversations.
Well, the point is that David Dimbleby, who I did an interview with, the BBC, is one of the famous family. And he said, well, you must have a very long weekend. So we have me as a Muslim convert or revert, and my sister and cousin, and the rest of the family, Roman Catholic primarily. But
that's serious interfaith dialogue.
That's definitely, yes. And it's certainly kosher or halal food on the table, which we haven't got around to throwing at each other quite yet. But the point is that the evidence that I've gathered now from the 1988, there was a document done basically about the Balkanization of the Middle East. This is the plan of Greater Israel. That this is without doubt, and therefore to break up all the states into small Balkanized entities is precisely what Israel wants. And in 1962, David Ben Gurion was interviewed in Look magazine and Life magazine, in which he pointed out the world as it would become. And by 1987, the Cold War would be over. But America would become a welfare state with a planned economy. Now, we can see what's happening in the elections and the whole concept. Not that I'm against Bernie Sanders' concept. It could all be done if you follow Abraham Lincoln's monetary model without having to borrow. But Ben-Gurion predicted that world government would be in Jerusalem. And what's interesting, that Rahm Emanuel has the plan, and basically who has been the marionette controller of Obama has been Rahm Emanuel, who is, of course, I think he's mayor of Chicago at the moment. And so the agenda is one for world government in Jerusalem. And he said in 1947, the United Nations is a Jewish concept from A to Z. So this has been the prelude of world government, and that is what we've been led towards now, United States of Europe. And I have an American map published in 1941 showing the United States of Europe with Hebrew land as one of the entities for the global government. And of course, Hebrew land is where world government will be declared. But they're going to come unstuck because the hadith says, when Dajjal fails to bring the world under his control through his machinations and systems of false beliefs, the Christian nations will gather under 80 banners and ultimately bring about the destruction. But the second coming of Isa alayhi salam and al-Mahdi have to happen first, and that's the good news.
Now, how close are we to this? I know Sheikh Imran Hossein thinks that we're very, very close to the Akhir al-Zaman, the end times, and the war. He's actually afraid we're on the eve of a great war that could kill most of humanity. What do you think?
I think that if I have a collection, in fact, if I reach here, this book is a collection of hadith from Sunni sources, and Shia sources by a Shia scholar, and he's called Al-Mahdi. When you study all of them and you combine it with the destruction of Syria and Iraq are the prelude. The destruction of Iraq and Syria are the prelude to this, the emergence of Al-Imam Mahdi. And of course, the black flags, there'll be two lots of black flags. And of course, he will come out of Khorasan, or what we currently call Afghanistan. Now, my great-great-grandfather was, he ran the office of the East India Company in Dhaka, in Bengal. And of course, even then, they were discussing it in missives between the various heads. They knew that the Muslims had this secret weapon. So they sent an army to the northwest frontier to prevent the coming out of Al-Mahdi. They knew then, the British, and of course the Israelis know more than anybody because they've had access and they've controlled everybody basically for the past 400 or 500 years.
So you're expecting Al-Mahdi to come out of somewhere around Afghanistan?
Khorasan. Yeah, well, because all of, Afghanistan, Pakistan,
parts of Iran,
part of it was Khorasan, the greater Khorasan.
Mm-hmm.
And I think all the things that we're seeing, why are the Americans there, why are the British there, why have been there for such a long time, because they know that that is the point where they will be defeated.
That's a very interesting view. It does seem that this invasion, the destruction of Iraq at the same shortly after the invasion and occupation of Afghanistan, you know, we were told, of course, that that was revenge for 9/11, which, yeah, of course, is all nonsense. It was a false flag. And it seemed that there was a bit of a split politically between the people who were in favor of going straight into Iraq, which was the neoconservatives, and then the so-called realists who wanted to take over Afghanistan to control the global grand chessboard. What you're suggesting, though, is that there's another dimension here, which is this plot against the Islamic awakening in general and the possibility of a Mahdi arising out of Khorasan, as predicted in the Ahadith in particular. How would we recognize the forces of this Mahdi?
Well, from what I can understand, I have a very close friend who had a very vivid dream about things, and he is saying that he dreamt that the enclave where all the ambassadors are, all the diplomatic missions in Pakistan, I think it's Islamabad, it must be somewhere near there, but it's seen that an army in the dream that had emerged in traditional Arab dress, but also with conventional new weaponry and everything emerging and actually taking control of the whole enclave. But the missing hadith that I was referring to, actually from 1908, they actually mention Hitler by name. They mention Saddam by name. They mention the events that would occur. But one very important point about Hitler, that in the year 1330 Hijri year, exactly in the year he comes to power, and the year he is killed by the secret forces of the Russians. Now, the secret forces in 2006, whoever compiled the hadith could not have had the information that we had in the 21st century. But a lady who was part of the team that went with what was prior to the KGB, it was the NKDV, I think it was, she was the interpreter. And all of the people who went with that group were all Jewish. And she said that she took Hitler's jaw to Stalin in her lunchbox and part of a skull. Now, that publication was in June 2006. Nobody knew that, but the Hadith, the Prophet says, Hitler will be killed by the secret forces of the Russians. Now, so before 2006, and unless you're a member of the KGB, you could never have said that, because Hitler had three lookalikes. So whoever was killed or committed suicide, these are the things that the Hadith tell us. Then we come to Saddam, he enters the little Kuwait while he is being betrayed. Now, we know about April Glaspie and everything. And we talk about Gamal Abdel Nasser, the Arabs will worship him and he will be humiliated in two wars. But Egypt will be granted success in one war in Ramadan, but he will make a treaty with those who rob Masjid al-Aqsa. And then it comes to the point where America, an adulteress, will come out and she will be destroyed.
Now, how do we verify that these are authentic hadith, or indeed, I'm sure some skeptical listeners or viewers might be wondering, well, could this have perhaps been, you know, forged and even backdated? Because there is an interpretation that sometimes prophecies are sort of backdated for political reasons.
Yeah, absolutely. But there's one very interesting thing. You've just said a really brilliant point. The hadith mentions the emergence of, after the Hijri, so many after Hitler, will emerge Nasser. But it is 8 years, there's an 8 year lag before he actually appears. So if we've been doing it, if CNN or anybody been doing it, they would have actually made sure that the date hadn't been altered, hadn't been. But there is a delay in some things. If people make dua, they can change or delay certain things happening. But nobody could have backdated the 2006 revelation from Ellen Oreskovaya, because nobody knew it. So, but the hadith are there. We have the original Arabic, handwritten Arabic document from 300 Hijri.
Really?
So, yeah, we've got them. I have them here with me, and I'll send them to you.
That's quite amazing.
Yeah.
So the question of sort of where is all of this going is an interesting one. The ideas range from a great war that kills most of humanity, which is what Sheikh Imran Hossein is afraid of, to perhaps something better than that. But many people believe that Islam, which is monotheism 1.3, that embraces and corrects but protects and shelters the earlier monotheisms, will return to take its place kind of as the middle way of the planet, which is what it used to be. I mean, there was up to a third of the people on Earth were Muslim not that many centuries ago. And it was only the European expansion of the past 500 years that changed that. And a lot of folks are seeing the likelihood of an Islamic resurgence one way or another, demographically or by whatever means. And many of us suspect that part of the reason for this global war on Islam, disguised as a global war on terror, is to try to stop that.
Right.
So when Imam Mahdi, you know, the eschatology here, of course, is that Jesus, Sayyidina Isa, returns as along with Imam Mahdi, another figure who's specifically Islamic. And Muslims would say this is to establish Islam or reestablish Islam. Christians, of course, have their own interpretation. But what do you see as a kind of a likely scenario?
Well, I think from having spent a lot of time piecing bits together, the forensic evidence, and I'll come to something else shortly, but the actual timeline is that Al-Imam Mahdi will come. There will be a major fight between the holders of the black flags and the ones with the other black flags, of which will be the supporters of him. So this will happen first. He will be successful. Then he'll flee to Mecca, and then they will send an army, which, according to what I can understand, will come from an army of 30,000 troops will come from Kuwait. And they will sink in the land just outside Medina. So then this will be then the turning point of the whole event. But Isa, he then returns to Damascus, and then Isa descends by the White Tower, which is still hasn't been destroyed. So looking at Damascus now, the actual construction of what's there is still intact, ready for that event. But clearly, there will be a success. But you talk about this major explosion, this event. In this hadith collection, it tells us that on a certain Friday, to lock yourselves in your houses, close the doors and windows, and do not venture out, but just recite certain verses from the Quran. I'll send all this to you. It's all compiled. And so you can look at the information, but it's all very much in line with what we can see now on the ground, very much indeed.
Now, the idea of Quranic surahs having a protective value against, in this case, it sounds like almost against radiation poisoning or something, is interesting. I know that the Muawwidatain, the last two surahs in Quran, are often recited for spiritual protection. And interestingly enough, David Jacobs, who was the leading mainstream American professor researching the UFO phenomenon as folklore, and of course at that point, up until the mid-90s, he was just calling it folklore. In the mid-90s, he came out with a book called The Threat, which argues that there are actual UFO abductions going on, perhaps millions every year. And he studied people's efforts to resist this. You know, people who consider themselves abduction victims try everything to stop it. They'll set up a videotape or a video camera pointed at their beds at night, and what they see in the morning, and they know they've been abducted because they can feel it, is they see the video showing them getting up, walking over to the camera, and turning it off. And according to Jacobs, these ETs, or whatever they are, beam people through ceilings and walls, etc., etc. The only thing, he says, that's ever been known to stop these abductions is people reciting the Muawwidatain. It's very interesting, because Jacobs is not Muslim himself, but that's what he discovered by researching this. Perhaps you could mention, you know, or discuss briefly, what do you think these entities are that are involved in these abductions that can be protected against by the Muawwidatain?
Well, the jinn clearly inhabit this world with us. To believe that they don't is folly raised to the highest power. And that the little people in Ireland, I mean, with a name like Kevin, you must hear, you know about the little people, but the peris or the angel, the fairies, of course, migrated when, after, if we go to the Ark of Noah, after the flood, I've been there and we've done all the evidence from the Ark of Noah is actually on Mount Judy in the southern part of Turkey. Now, all the tribes of the world migrated from that point after the flood, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and the sons and daughter-in-laws of Noah. But what people believe are Babylonian myths, when you actually show them the hard evidence, where you've done, I mean, Galbraith Laboratories in America, there was a very, very good American archaeologist, Ron Wyatt. If you look at his website, you'll find some of the most superb evidence of Noah's Ark, the crossing point of Bani Israel coming out of Egypt, cross into Saudi Arabia, and the chariots of Pharaoh are on the seabed between Nuweiba and Arabia. And the split rock in Horeb, the Mount Sinai, is in Arabia. And people, they don't believe you until you say, well, look, read Paul's Galatians 24-25. And it tells you Mount Sinai is in Arabia. So what we've actually been seduced away from the facts of Mount Sinai, Noah's Ark, and in the battle we just had recently was with the lesbian and gay lobby, refusing to want to let us teach children in Muslim schools about Sodom and Gomorrah, or the destruction. But when you show them the actual city that still remains at the foot of Masada, with everything as it was described in the Quran, then this, of course, it puts them on one leg, and we have to fight against the dumbing down and the denying us confidence from the evidence.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's another interesting issue, is the changes in the culture that seem to have been engineered by what some people call the New World Order, that these Freemasonic governing outfits are interested in spreading a kind of moral chaos and breaking down the family unit, which has been the basis of human society throughout all of history. Maybe you could comment on that.
Yes, well, Peter Sutherland, who is the United Nations, I think, Commissioner for Migration, in a document that I received a few weeks ago, he said, we must disrupt all existing groups, particularly in Europe, to send in migrants and to send in to destroy the cohesion of groups who might resist. And this is the United Nations Commissioner in a document that is approved by them. So we shouldn't be surprised. But remember, Allah didn't create one tribe of Israel. He created 12 because you need to have a sense of belonging. But it is satanic, demonic. And I digressed a little bit from the point you're asking, who are the entities? The entities are the jinn, who can travel anywhere in the blink of an eye. And they can perform miracles and do all the things that people become completely besotted by. So the jinn are there, and maybe David Icke, who I've met a few times, he talks about these giant lizards and what have you. But the jinn manifest themselves in any shape except that of the Prophet. So they can appear as anything you wish. And they can abduct and take people wherever they want and make them appear that they've had, an out-of-body experience. But as many people said, they've had more of an out-of-pocket experience than an out-of-body experience.
I'm sure they have. So you think that David Icke's reptilian extraterrestrials actually could just be a kind of an illusion? That's what people would be seeing. You know, they see the Queen of England suddenly shape-shifting and looking like an extraterrestrial reptile, devouring human flesh and drinking human blood, and probably that's more of a djinn-based illusion.
Well, certainly, probably the drinking as much gin as that, they would have that illusion anyway. But interesting with David Icke, he came to Sheffield to see myself, and after I'd finished the book, he tends to plagiarize quite a lot of stuff, David, but he came to see somebody who is called Geoffrey Basil Smith. Now, Geoffrey Basil Smith, I don't know if he's still alive, but he was a journalist with Sheffield Star. But he then became the Grand Baphomet of the OTO, Ordo Templi Orientis, and he living in Sheffield in a small terrace house. Now, he wrote a book called The Knights of the Solar Cross. Of course, the cross is a symbol of Dajjal. And but he then was basically unburdened himself. His father had converted to Islam, and he came for nearly a year to our house. My wife didn't know who he was or what he was, otherwise she would never let him in. But we then compiled what I called the Dark Knights of the Solar Cross. And he was then telling me he'd learnt everything about Freemasonry in a dream, all the degrees, maybe over two nights. And he then was then appointed as the Grand Baphomet of the OTO, and people from America would come to his house.
And the OTO was Crowley's organization, wasn't it?
Creepy Crowley, as we call him, Aleister Crowley. And they then, a book was written by Stephen Knight called, the Brotherhood. And Martin Short, who became a good friend of mine, he'd written several books on the Mafia and a television series. He wrote Inside the Brotherhood, and that's a book in which I collaborated with him on Jehovah, Javelin, and a few other things. But Geoffrey Basil Smith, he told me all about the initiation, the things like with, we've just had this monstrous scandal with Jimmy Savile, who is one of the top presenters on television, you know, the music industry, which I was a singer, I was in the music business at the time of Joe Cocker, who was a good friend of mine. So I've been through the whole. They say in Sheffield, you don't need to open every door in an asylum to realize you're in a madhouse. Mm-hmm. But in my case, I did. I opened most of them to understand. But Geoffrey Basil Smith took me to places where certain initiations were going on and the revival of the Golden Dawn, which took place in Regent's Park. So this thing goes on. It's real. These people are absolutely involved. Right, above their head, and they actually believe and they worship the jinn and they worship Shaitan. There's no doubt about that.
Right, and the fact that there are these cults, including Freemasonry, that help promote their members to higher positions in places like the police and judiciary seems to be one of the reasons why somebody like Jimmy Savile can molest hundreds and hundreds of children, perhaps even killing some of them for years and years, right out in the open, really, and nobody can touch him.
Well, in this book, I've included all the judges in the High Court in the UK, that up to the time when I had the last yearbook. But it is now rampant in Rotherham, which is a small town, a steel town, near to Sheffield, where I grew up. They've just had, they've been covering up child abuse for at least 1,400 children, young children, and they're still covering it up because the police are corrupt, the judiciary is corrupt, and they're all involved in fraud, defrauding people and making them penniless so they become less vociferous and complaining. So it is a conspiracy, but Thomas Jefferson that gave us the analysis for conspiracy. You know, he said something that keeps happening through changes of office to all too clearly show that there is a conspiracy to basically defraud us and impoverish us.
And no question about it. I think most of my listeners by now have figured out that there is.
We shall.
Yes. Well, we only have a few minutes left, and I wanted to touch on the work you've done about, was it King John who was going to come to Islam at one point, or wrote a letter to the King of Morocco along those lines, and likewise Napoleon's conversion to Islam. Can you give us the short version of those two stories?
Indeed. Well, King John went because he was in most of the wars with England and France. As Napoleon said, have been guerre de usury, wars of usury, of riba. Mm-hmm. King John was, of course, his brother was off on the crusade. He was under enormous pressure and turned to what he thought would be, you know, he would actually do the flip side and go over to the opposite side, and sent three ambassadors to Morocco. The caliph refused, basically, thinking that, if you have such a good place, why would you submit yourself in with Bayer to me? And basically sent them off with a flea in their ear, which must have been like the guy who failed to sign the Beatles. It must have been almost as bad as that. So that was the event. King John, of course, the Magna Carta, was basically the event that was foisted upon him. But the Magna Carta has basically been overridden now. But what a disaster in terms of public relations. If you'd had England as your ally, then of course the what has happened in the world would never have happened, because of this center. Of course, England became powerful because of Hadid, iron, and the Quran tells us in Hadid is the means of mighty warfare. So that would have been a major anchor for the Islamic world. But unfortunately, he sent them off, basically humiliating them, the caliph in Morocco. Mm-hmm. But more important is this book, Napoleon and Islam, which is a translation of the original archives that were come from Napoleon's period in office. This was published in 1914. By Christian Scherfies in French. I was given one quotation, which I included in the book Satanic Voices, Ancient and Modern, and in which Napoleon said he hoped the time was not far off when he would gather all the wise and educated people, establish a uniform regime based on the Quran, which alone is true and alone can lead men to happiness. Christianity teaches only servitude. The whole archive, this one we had translated, and I'm going to do it as a back-to-back French-English version, which I'd hoped to do last year for the bicentenary of Waterloo. But Napoleon clearly understood the problems, and what people are unaware of, that his civil code, which is the basis for all European law, only 6% is non-Islamic. The fiqh of Imam Malik is the basis for his civil code.
Really?
Now, isn't that an important...
Yeah, and that's interesting. That brings us to a Moroccan connection with both of these cases of King John and Napoleon, because, of course, Morocco is the leading Maliki country.
Yes, exactly. And also, of course, we're Bob Hope and Bing Crosby are more famous for going to Morocco in our parlance. But what's so important is that... when Napoleon was both like American Civil War, all the wars, English Civil War, are funded by both sides by the same bankers, the same family, Rothschild mainly. Napoleon realized that he'd been duped, and basically he turned the tables on the revolution. And of course, when you read his encounter with Goethe, has lunch with Napoleon, and it's part of the appendices here. I'll send you the full book as a PDF when we finish today, inshallah, so you've got that. It's all validated. The original documents are in the museums and the military archives in Paris. But Napoleon, when he recognized that war with England had always been wars over usury debt, And when he saw the debt of France, which grew from like a cancer in the body, it grows exponentially. So he saw the debt of France and he said, the deadly facts herein reveal that it is amazing that this monster interest has not devoured all humanity. It would have done so long ago had not bankruptcy and revolution acted as counterpoisons. Almost in the same week, Thomas Jefferson, certainly in 1815, in his letter to Gallatin, who I think was the Treasury Secretary, Jefferson said, the modern theory for the perpetuation of debt has drenched the earth with blood and crushed its inhabitants under burdens ever accumulating. How about that?
That's beautiful. And so but the takeaway here is that Islam is still hanging on to its traditional teaching against usury more so than the other faiths.
And that's what the danger is to the bankers. They want it out of the way. The changing of scripture from the Christian, like the Scots, still the Lord's Prayer in Scotland is, forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. Of course, south of the border, the head of the usurers in London, it's all been changed. As people say, we're now more Bank of England than Church of England. So Islam is the threat because they failed to alter the scripture. If they could have twisted it like they did with the Torah and with the Injil, they would have been quite happy, and the Muslims would have been basically in left field, unfortunately. But we've fought to hang on to it, and we've defeated them in Malaysia. Once you understand the money game, and of course, Abraham Lincoln's fantastic 18-point plan is brilliant. But if I've got 2 minutes, this is what was said in...
Barely 2 minutes.
2 minutes. Capital, this is from Montague Norman, who quoted from the 1897 American Bankers Charter. Capital must protect itself in every possible way, both by combination and legislation. Debts must be collected, mortgages foreclosed as rapidly as possible. When through the process of law, the common people lose their homes, they will become more docile and more easily governed through the strong arm of the government applied by a central power of wealth under leading financiers. These truths are well known amongst our principal men, who are now engaged in forming an imperialism to govern the world. By dividing voters through the political party system, we can get them to expend their energies in fighting for questions of no importance. It is thus by discreet action we can secure for ourselves that which has been so well planned and successfully accomplished.
It sounds like it's right out in the open.
It sounds like what you have in the States with Clinton and Trump. It's just it's a bun fight, but they're getting on stealing the nation, and that's what we've got to fight against. The Federal Reserve is private. Bank of England is private. We've got to kick them out. That's the only solution.
Okay, and that document you were quoting from is?
This was the Montague Norman giving his address to the United States Bankers Association in 1924 based on the original document by the American Bankers Association from the Texas Mercury 1897 disclosure.
Okay, well, that's...
Charles Lindbergh. Lindbergh was the disclosure.
That's right. Okay, well, thank you so much, David Pidcock. I appreciate your terrific work, and I think we've ended on pretty much the most crucial note of all. So keep up the good work, God willing, and we'll talk again.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Assalamu
alaikum. Wa alaikum assalam.
Oh Allah, the Almighty. Allahu Allah. Protect me and guide me. Allahu Allah. Oh, to your love and mercy. Allahu Allah. Ya Allah, don't deprive me. Allahu Allah. Beholding your beauty, Allahu Allah. Oh, my Lord, accept this plea, Allahu Allah.